All right, I am Jen, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And I'm just going to be real honest that I'm going to be real honest. And I don't know really what's going to come out of my mouth because the words be thine and the voice be mine. But, you know, I'm going to tell you who I was, what happened, and where I am now. But where I am now is going to be short because, quite honestly, I feel like where I am and where I was, the line is still not completely, you know, unblurred. My sobriety date is coming up on June 30th. I'll have 1 year, so just shy of 1 year. But my journey into AA did not start a year ago. You know, I went into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in 2014. And I had 9 months, and I thought I had it all figured out, but did not, and I lost 4 years of my life. So I am going to share with you, I'm going to share some fun facts about me, just because I'm going to break the ice and get out of myself. I was born on tax day. That was April 15th, 1973. Don't do the math on that. My last name is Weir, and I always tell people, how do you spell your last name? W-E-I-R, weird without the D, duh. I grew up super awkward, I grew one boob in fourth grade, and it was, like, a really big boob, and the other boob was real flat, and, like, I had to go to the doctor for that, and I just remember the awkwardness and the insecurity. Clearly, it caught up, but I like to say I graduated in the top 32 of my class. There was only 32. I went to optometry school. I packed up my car at age 20, and I drove down. It was a Ford Escort. I even had the sunroof put in it. Like, it didn't come with it, so they even put it in. It kind of leaked a little, whatever. And that cost me, like, $200 to do that. I thought it was really cool. Drove to Atlanta. Knew no one except for my weird cousin, who's now homeless in Charleston, and didn't know anybody. And I established a life here. I did get arrested at age 20. I got charged with escape. Like, I got arrested, I got away, and then got re-caught. So, yeah, that was definitely was drinking. I got my own cell in the Atlanta City Jail. That was super awkward, too. A lot of my story is going to be awkward, like right now is awkward. At 25, I fell off the Grand Canyon. I was hiking. I was down at the bottom. I fell 25 feet. I was helicoptered out, and I was in a wheelchair. At 39, I won Fear Factor. At 40, I went to my first AA meeting. And I am a complicated, conflicted, grateful alcoholic. My mom had me when she was 17. She was married my dad October of her senior year. I was born April of her senior year. You know, my dad is an alcoholic. He's a functioning alcoholic, but still an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic. One of my only memories of my grandfather was dumping a bottle of beer over my grandma's head at dinner. Like, I remember, like, thinking to myself, that's not normal. But, you know, I didn't know any different. I don't know how old I was. So my mom was 17, my dad was 21 maybe, I don't know. My mom worked as a waitress, and we lived in, when I was born, they lived in what they called the Sugar Shack, which I don't even want to know. But I don't think it had running water. I know it did not have a bathroom. We then upgraded to a trailer, which I don't remember living in the trailer. But then we moved into, and this is like rural. Like, I'm from Michigan, so this is Michigan, and I'm from the UP, which is, the town I live in has like 700 people in it. They still do. Like, when I go home, I'm like Reese Witherspoon on Sweet Home Alabama. Like, oh, you have a baby in a bar. Okay. And you're still mad about eighth grade. So when I go home, it's much like that. Everybody knows everybody. And, you know, geographically, I couldn't wait to get out of there. So then I went to college. Then I moved here. So, you know, I did the geographical changes that we all do. So she was young, super young. She worked as a waitress. And my first memory was we had moved into this big, big, big old house. Like, and this is truly my first memory. And I remember the wallpaper, but I had a babysitter. There wasn't many people that lived in my town, and they were a family friend, and they were male, and they would lock me in this bedroom. And I remember looking down this old dirt road and wishing that my mom would come home and wishing I wasn't alone. And I had a sister. I was four, and my sister was two, and she was there, and I remember comforting her and whatever. But then I remember not being alone. And I think that that was like my first time that I recognized God. You know what I mean? And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know, oh, well, that's God, you know, until you have spiritual experiences as you get older. I realized that was one. Like, it was dark, but there was light. So then that, I don't know how long that kind of abuse continued, but then it moved into abuse of a sexual nature, and my soul was shredded at that time, but I did not know that my soul was shredded. I was four. You know, I got attention. They were giving attention to my sister, and I carried that shame and that secret around for years and years. And, you know, all the awkwardness, that feeling of inadequacy or that feeling of shame was always there, but I didn't know it. I didn't know. And then I was, I also have an aunt who's a Catholic nun, biggest hypocrite I ever met in my life, but she's still a Catholic nun, and we went to church all the time, and I went to confession every week just to say the same things. I cheated on a test because I only graduated 32 in my class. You know, I swore, I disobeyed, whatever. And then that was the first time after catechism class that I had wine. I don't know how old I was. I mean, I couldn't have been very old. And the priest gave us all wine, and I remember wanting more wine. And then I lived down the hill from the Catholic church, and I was, like, walking home, and I was like, damn, that wine was good. I'm going to go back to that one day. And I was a good girl, though, because, I mean, I didn't really even do much in high school. I didn't date the bad boys, and I broke some hearts, but then I went to college, and that's when I really, you know, I was a binge drinker. So, you know, one wasn't enough, and 10 wasn't enough, and I passed out one night at the, I guess I wanted McDonald's, and we went to McDonald's before we were going to go to a bar, and I went to the bathroom, and I passed out in the bathroom, sitting on the toilet like this for 3 hours, and no one knew where I was, and they were all looking for me, and then they found me. They were like, oh, there you are. I'm like, where did you think I would be? Moved to McDonald's. I didn't even remember. I didn't remember that. You know, so then I would straighten up. I would drink. I'd binge drink, straighten up. And then went to college. And I did much better in college than I did in high school just because I was more focused. And, you know, I couldn't wait to be an adult. Yeah. So then I became an adult, drove down to Atlanta. You know, then my drinking was, again, binge drinking, again, weekends. Like, I maintained a job. I could drink on a Friday night, but I could not wait for Friday night. Like, and everything revolved around alcohol. Like, oh, Survivor's on tonight. Yay, we get to drink. Or my parents are coming. I get to drink. For, you know, just that feeling of always wanting to drink and having an excuse to drink and drinking too much and having friends around you, I would gravitate towards the people who drank like me, you know? And, like, when you leave this room, you're going to know me better than a lot of people even who live under my roof. But you already know me because I know you, you know? We know each other, which is how we stay sober. But I, you know, I would drink and I would gravitate towards the people who drank like me. And two of those people are no longer here. You know, they never got sober. One was a girl that was a mom and two kids, and we drank like fish. And then I pulled away from her because I was not going to drink like her. Still did. You know, I just didn't drink myself into the grave. So then I had kids, and I got married and had kids, and I thought, this is it. You know, like, I'm going to control my drinking. I didn't drink while I was pregnant. I did drink while I was nursing because I was like, oh, well, they'll sleep better, and they did. So, yeah, I've been known to nurse a baby and have a glass of wine in my hand. But staying at home with my kids was probably the worst thing for me. I mean, you know, I'm active. I like to have a career. I like, and don't get me wrong, my kids are wonderful, and I don't regret that time. But looking back on it, I realize how taxing that was for me mentally and emotionally and just, you know, really, I was kind of isolated, and then you'd have playgroups, and then playgroups had wine, like sippy cups and Chardonnay kind of, you know, mentality, and, you know, it's very unhealthy. Happy hours went from Fridays to Thursdays, Fridays, you know, and then Sunday, just all of the craziness. Finally had two kids, and then I wasn't going to have any more kids, but God had another plan, and I had my third child, and I remember thinking, okay, well, good. I'm glad I'm pregnant because now I can stop drinking. You know, I'm not going to drink anymore because I'm pregnant. And this time I'm going to get it. And I didn't. I managed to, I never got a DUI, but God, you know, in this room we talk about God's grace, but I want to talk about God's mercy because I have it written down here. I wrote it a long time ago, but it says, God's grace is the blessing he has given me. But God's mercy is the second, third chances and the blanket of protection he has given me while I was not in direct contact with him. And I really believe that. Like, I wrote that down for my step two. I did, like, all this crazy journaling when I first started working the steps because when I decided I'd had enough of drinking, it was 2014. But in 2010, my daughter, my youngest, was, I had a four-year-old, a six-year-old and an eight-year-old, and my daughter got sick, and she got really sick, and I took her to the emergency room, and, you know, they sent her home with me, they did blood work, they told me everything was fine, but I ended up bringing her in, like, her oxygen level was 50, you know, and they moved us to Scottish Rite, then they moved us to Eggleston, and she ended up on this machine called ECMO. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of ECMO. You might hear of it now more with COVID, but she had a lot of the lung thing that COVID had. And, you know, during that time, I believed in God. Like, this whole time I was going through all of this stuff, I always believed in God. Now, it wasn't the God of a religion. It was just a God of a higher power, you know, which is what makes these rooms so precious, is because you cannot have to believe in the same religion. But we don't know what God is. And during that time, God showed me his face. Like, I remember the doctor saying to me, "This we can't do anything else for. You know, we've dialed up the machine." And I was like, okay. Like, what do you, you know, like, it's not, you're not going to save her anyway. You know what I mean? I didn't say that to him because he was like, oh, you know. But you're not going to save her. And God showed his face to me. And he showed it so brilliantly and so beautifully that I didn't feel worthy of it. I didn't feel worthy of it because of the shame that was shredded in my soul. I didn't feel worthy of it just because I was an alcoholic. And, you know, the self-battery that we do to ourselves is real. And it keeps us drinking, I do believe. If we don't forgive ourselves for the things of our past, whether they're big or little, you're going to drink again. You are. And I did that for a long time. It was torture. So she gets better, and I drink. And I mean drink. And I just, I don't know why. I mean, I know why. Because I believe I'm an alcoholic, innate, an alcoholic. But I just couldn't grasp the fact that I deserved what I had. And you know, so that was 2010, and I drank for 4 years. And the line would move. Everybody has a line, and we always move it. Like, oh, I crossed that line. Well, the line gets a little grayer, a little bit fuzzy. Make a new line. Pass that line. My line was like, oh, I would drink a couple glasses of wine while I was cooking dinner. And then I would drink, you know, while we did homework, because then the homework was tolerable. Or I would drink before the kids got home because then I'd be happier when they got home. And then I was just drinking in the morning just to drink. And I would drive my kids while drinking. I would plan how to drink. I'd find wine bottles. I'd find bottles, you know. I was a drunk soccer mom. I mean, I would drive them to soccer practice and I'd sit in the in the van and drink. And it was torture. It was pure torture. And I coached them in basketball, and I remember thinking I couldn't wait, because I think it might have been a Sunday or Saturday. I couldn't wait to finish the game so I could go get something to drink. And then I found this note, and I don't remember writing it. And I just know that it's from January 10th, 2014, and this is how much in denial we can be in. I'm like, wow, today sucked. Tomorrow will suck. Wait, and what am I going to do? You're not hiding from anyone. Your true self is out there. What the hell did I write? What are you not happy about? And I wrote, you are a bitch, a selfish bitch who cannot control her emotions, or is it you don't know who you are? And I wrote, I am in crisis. And I went to AA 4 days later. Now, I didn't have like someone go, oh, let's have an intervention. You know, like a lot of what I was doing, it's not that I was hiding from anyone. I think that people probably weren't ready to, nothing tragic had happened. Like, I didn't get a DUI. I didn't, you know, leave my kid somewhere. I didn't do any of those things, but I was about to. I mean, that line was about to be all a mess. So January 13th was my dad's birthday, and I missed talking to him because I was so hungover. And then I just got up, and I remember looking for the How place, because this is back, you know, I didn't know about, I tried to find an AA meeting on the internet or whatever. And I drove up and down this road, I'm pretty sure, and I was like, where the hell is this place? So I live in Ackworth, and I'm like, well, I'll go to Cartersville. So I started going to Cartersville, and I met some wonderful people in Cartersville, and like I said previously, I got a little time under my belt, and then I went back to work. I'm like, look at me, I am achieving some stuff. Like, I went to optometry school, so I went to work for an ophthalmologist, and it took one person, like one, to say, oh, well, you have 9 months, I'm sure you can drink now. And I'm like, you know what, yeah, I probably can. Now, mind you, that time when I had the 9 months, I didn't pick up the book. Like, what's the big book? Like, didn't read one thing. All I knew about Dr. Bob and Dr. Bill or whoever, they were some weird guys on the wall. Like, I didn't, you know, and the meeting was not structured like the meeting is here. We just literally sat around, everyone vomited in the room, and I took what I could, and that was about it. So when the line wasn't far for me to go, yeah, I probably could drink again. And then I drank, and drank for 3.5 more years. And how fun was that? No, not fun, because you knew enough about Alcoholics Anonymous without cracking a book to know you were miserable and to know that I may not have lived if I kept that up. You know, and I like to say that AA is like the mafia, right? So you can't talk about what you hear or see here or who's in here. But if you leave here, you can die. And that's how it felt. Like, I'm like, Jesus, I've been in the mafia. And I can't control my drinking. And then there were people who knew I got sober and people who, like, oh, I thought she quit drinking. Oh, well, you know what I mean? Or people who say, what do you mean you're not drinking? Like, why aren't you drinking? And if I was the mom that was behind the bus, you know, behind the bus smoking crack, and then you said, I quit smoking crack. Oh, well, thank God you quit smoking crack. But wine or alcohol is the only thing you have to, like, explain away. Like, I'm not drinking because I'm an alcoholic. You know, and you say that, and people are like, holy shit, well, did something happen? Yeah, I had a spiritual awakening. And I do also, you know, we talk about how alcohol is the snake, like, don't pick it up. But in my mind, I see alcohol as like the scorpion that wraps through my spine. And if I'm not working these steps, and each step is a spine, a part of my spine, and it tightens up and tightens up and tightens up, it's going to sting me. Like, I have to stay in the present. I have to stay in the steps. I have to stay in the rooms. I have to work with a sponsor. Yeah, that was a shit show, because sponsorship to me was very difficult, and it has to do with my own ego and the fact that I had a difficulty trusting women. And, you know, my sponsor now is a gay yoga instructor. Thank God, perfect fit for me, because I could trust him. You know, so I had issues with trusting women. And, you know, looking back on my life, it had to do with the shredding of my soul, because then I was, you know, and going through the ebb and flow of becoming a woman and getting your heart broken and getting stabbed in the back by women. You know, that was an issue with me. Although I absolutely adore and love women, I just really had an issue with sponsorship and having someone tell me what to do and how they told me to do it. So, you know, that sponsorship is like shoes. You know, some are too loose, some are too tight, some have a broken heel. At the end of the day, and I used to get so annoyed by this, but, you know, we're all sick, Jennifer, we're all sick. Like, I get that! But someone needs to be less sick than me and help me out of this hole. And you know, it took me a while. It took me a while. And but now I feel, like, more present. I'm not by any means, like, when I say I'm going to talk about how I am now, that line is still, like, real fuzzy. Like, that's why I'm so honest in the room. So I'm not going to sit in here, and I'm not going to sit up here and tell you, oh, I have this all figured out now, tomorrow, in class, because that's not the case. I mean, sobriety is like marbles, right? Like, you've heard it in here, and anything you hear comes out of my mouth that makes sense probably didn't come from me. You know, we can't stack them up. We just can stole them away in a jar, you know, and hope that something doesn't happen that cracks the jar and all the marbles fall out, and then you're like, damn it, I gotta pick them all back up, because I'm not a one-chip wonder, you know, I'm definitely not, and I wasn't ready to come back after going out and drinking, because I'm like, oh, am I really ready to do this? But I had a girlfriend reach out to me and ask me if I wanted to go get coffee. Now, this girlfriend dated my brother-in-law for 6 years, and her and I drank together very heavily. She's an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. Perfect storm. Awesome. You couldn't stand, you know, family functions. We would just drink and hide it from our significant others. And then when she saw me getting sober, she started to get sober, but we did not do it together. 2000, whenever I came back this time, she reached out to me, do you want to have coffee? And I was like, coffee meaning, you know, like, I kind of knew, and I said, I'm not ready, and she said, I understand that. So then we started doing it together, and then she just couldn't stay sober, and, you know, focusing on her not staying sober and seeing how, like, scary it was. I mean, I've called 911, and, you know, her blood alcohol is 500, and over 500, and, you know, year in rehab, and, you know, those things scare the shit out of you. You know, and I think she's doing well now, but I am not. I don't have the courage or the heart to call her. And that's the first time I've admitted that, but I just kind of don't want to. And it makes me sad because she keeps relapsing, and I can't. I can't. You know, I'm not strong enough to watch that happen again. So I say, you know, I wasn't going to share about that, but here I am. Let's see. This is hard. I mean, every time I would sit down to write something to share with you guys, it was impossible. Like, I knew I wanted to share about how I was raised, but I didn't want to share too much. So every time I would sit down to write an outline or to think about what I was going to say, it was too hard. So then I just, so here I am. Doing this. But, you know, where I'm at today, what happened, like, my soul was just, couldn't take it anymore. You know, alcohol, that feeling, it talks about it in the doctor's opinion, which I wrote this down because it's resonated with me. That feeling of ease and comfort that first drink gave, you know, and that just kept me, like, because I hadn't worked the fourth step honestly and dug out the things and cut off the low fruit and all of the slogans, you know, I was always a little bit resistant. And, you know, telling on myself was hard because my ego was so big. Like, what do you mean? I'm the perfect mom. I have perfect kids. I've got a perfect house. I've got a perfect husband. Like, this is not going to take me down. Like, I'm going to figure this out on my own. Like, I figured everything else on my own. Guess what? That shit doesn't happen. You know, you're not going to be strong enough. You're not going to be willpower enough. That none of it is going to happen unless you do the work. You know, that feeling of loneliness and being lonely. Ugh. You know. And being in a room full of people and feeling alone. When I come in here, I'm in a room full of people and I know everyone. I mean, I could tell y'all anything and then be like, oh, me too. Or, yeah, that, you know. It's crazy. And the way the book, to me, written divinely. I mean, if anyone, you know, oh, it's... Be careful with that AA. It's a cult. I'm like, okay, define cult, because I'm pretty sure cult has one person, a head. And the way that AA is ran, the way the book was written, it just came from God, in my opinion. And, you know, I don't know what else to say except for that the problem wasn't that I drank too much. It was that I can't drink enough. You know, the hiding, the lying. It's cunning and baffling. Like, just, and then you can talk yourself into anything. Like, I could talk myself into, you know, anything. And blurred lines, and I don't know. Does anyone have any questions for me? I don't know what else to say. I drank. I was a shitty person. Now I'm better. No. So much more than that. What's your life been like? What's my life been like now? Well, those of you who know me and follow me on Facebook, what you see on Facebook is really true. And what's really true about my life is that my kids are amazing. Like, literally, my son plays baseball in college. He's going to be a junior next year. Got a full academic scholarship. My daughter will play college soccer next year. She got a full academic scholarship. My little one is like a soccer phenom. She practices all the time. I've never seen anyone practice as hard as an alcoholic trying to quit drinking. Like, she can juggle the ball. Her record is over 2,000 juggles without it touching the ground. Do you know how much mental toughness, not let alone like the actual act of it, but to be mentally that tough to do that is beyond words. You know, my life is not perfect, but on the outside looking in, it probably appears perfect, but I like to try to stay authentic. Like, I like to show the scars because otherwise I'm just a phony, you know? When I fell off the Grand Canyon, it was my one-year anniversary trip, and we were hiking, and that was, I had a spiritual experience then. And my husband, when I was in the wheelchair, would count out the pain pills, you know? And I'd be like, I'm not going to get addicted to pain pills. Like, yeah, probably. Like, he knew, you know, that I had that tendency. He also had a college roommate who got addicted to pain medicine, so he was super sensitive of that. And, you know, but when I fell, I just always knew God was there, because falling, first of all, what went through my head was, holy shit, I'm falling off the Grand Canyon, I'm going to die. And then when I landed, I'm like, oh, I'm not dead, but my back is broken, like it just knew. And then I wiggled my toes, and then, you know, we were at the bottom, so it took 2.5 hours, and there was like these deer that were there. They were off to the side. And I always think of religion as a spiritual thing. I don't think of it, like I mentioned, as a God, one God versus the next God. It irritates the living hell out of me that we have wars over something so beautiful. So the deer were off to the side. And my mom kept talking about the deer, and I had to lay there, and I was, you know, conscious, and I'm all broken up, like everything, my back, my foot, my ankle, my knee, my arm, except for this, like my head and this part was not broken. And I had to wait for the helicopter to get there. They had to take a smaller helicopter, to go down into the middle of the canyon, and those deer did not leave the whole entire time I was laying there. Like, they were just drinking water. The helicopter lands like 100 yards away. They did not leave. The helicopter was loud. It was echoing. Those deer did not leave. And then my mom said, if my mom kept talking and describing the deer, they did get a picture of the deer. I saw them later, but she said they didn't leave until the helicopter was gone, and then they just ran off. And I was like, that was like a sign from God. When I got married, it was outdoor wedding, and of course I was drinking and whatever. I told my mother-in-law to shut up on the wedding video, which I did not remember until we watched it. That was awful. Awful. But yeah, you know, like, I wanted to have a party. Like, hello, I was 24, and I had a party. But during the wedding, two birds flew over, and so I didn't see them. I didn't even see them, but people said, oh, those doves were so pretty. That, did you plan that? And I was like, no, but that was God. You know, like, I would live for God in the little things. And then when God showed me in the big things, it was hard, you know. It was hard because I didn't feel worthy. So my whole journey in sobriety has been coming to terms with feeling worthy, you know, being comfortable in my own skin and feeling vulnerable and worthy of love, people's love, God's mercies and graces, like, you know, to walk around your whole life and not feel worthy is so, so mind-blowing. But I don't feel that way anymore. Of course I have bad days. Like today I was terrified. I'm still terrified. You know, I'm like, I don't have enough to offer. I don't know what to say. Blah, blah, blah. All the negative self-talk. And I absolutely love Pink. Like, Pink's the hottest chick ever. And she's on my bucket list, but I don't think she would have anything to do with this 48-year-old woman. But if you listen to her, like, when I first got sober, I went to YouTube and listened to speaker meetings all the time, especially women. I would read books. No, disclaimer, I didn't read. I would listen to them on Audible about women, and that just kept me, like, going, because I'm like, oh, I'm not alone. Like, oh, yeah, I felt that way. You know, I've branched out now, and I listen to some of you dudes, but you're not as good as the women. But if you listen to Pink, you know, she's sober. She doesn't talk about it that much, but, like, you know, change the voices in your head. Act them, you know, make them like you instead. And when that song came out, pretty fucking perfect, my friend texted me, who's not an alcoholic, but a heavy drinker, and she said, I need you to listen to the song because you need to live this song. And I hadn't gone to Alcoholics Anonymous yet, but I listened to that on the way over here, and I'm like, you know what? I do. It changed the voices in my head, you know, and we all do. We all need to just, like, if yesterday you had a bad day and you were sassy and, you know, flipped somebody off, whatever you did, today's a new day. Like, every day's a new day. You can start your day over at any time. And I have been in a little cycle of not feeling the shiniest, you know, but I can tell you what I've been doing wrong. I haven't got up and haven't been exercising like I usually do. I took a whole week off from that, which means I took a week off of praying, because I have like a little thing, and then I was sleeping past that, and I was just like, okay, fuck it, I'm not doing it. Let me tell you something, driving over here, I was thinking, you have got to reset your button on Monday, you know, get back and do the routine. Routine is so important for me and my peace of mind, my mental health, you know, and it's so easy to get off of. It's so easy to say, I think I'll hit the snooze button, and like yesterday, I came to the meeting, I wasn't going to come to the meeting, and my husband said, are you not going to your meeting? And I was like, and then I was like, yes, I'm going to the meeting, and I came in here with cut-off shorts on and a baseball hat on, and Steve was like, hey, Jen, I just want you to know that I like this redneck look you have going on. And I was like, I have so many looks, Steve, so many. But that's how I felt. That's how I felt on the outside, you know. So you have to get up every day. You have to show up. You have to do the work. Because, you know, when I came in here, my face was bloated. And I was 20 pounds heavier. I looked like shit. of course, I thought I looked beautiful because I was buzzed all the time, you know? But, yeah. And then it's hard to believe, you know, how much your face changes and your body changes and your attitude changes when you're away from the alcohol. You know, of course, the pink cloud's a real thing. And, you know, when I see someone with a really high pink cloud, if you don't know what that is, it's when you first get sober and you feel so amazing because this thing that's been killing you, this poison that you just can't put down, is away from you. You're like, oh, I can breathe. And then I'm always like, oh, don't get too high. But my sponsor says that. Like, I'll call him and be like, oh, guess what? I got this great listing and I'm going to do this. And he'd be like, okay, well, don't get too excited about that, Jennifer. And I'm like, come on. These are the promises and they're coming true. And then, well, don't get too sad. I am like a 90 to nothing kind of chick. Like, my mind literally, like, is a pinball machine. I have a playlist on my phone that's like Jen's pinball machine, and it's got like Poison, it's got like Martina McBride and all of these things, like, because I can't decide what genre I want to listen to. And it's like, oh my God, sometimes you just need peace. And I think, like, you know, and then I would calm that mind down with alcohol. Now I have to calm that mind down with prayer, meditation, working the steps. You know, I change all the time. I'm like, oh, well, step one is the most important step. Huh. Well, yeah, we have to admit that. But then step four is the most important step. Yeah, you have to do that. But then you also have to do step 11 where you pray. Because honestly, if you're not quiet and still, you're not going to get the messages. It's not when we're talking and my brain is like, ding, 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 ding. You know, like, it's like when I go, okay, let's just calm down for a minute and use less words, and, you know, that's when the answers come. And, you know, disappointments, I'm never really afraid of disappointments. Like, if something doesn't go my way, I always feel like there's a reason for that. So I didn't drink necessarily because things disappointed me. I didn't drink necessarily because things went well. I just drank all the time. You know what I mean? Like, I just drank all the time. And bad things happen to me because I drank? No, not really. Because, you know what? I've been sober, and bad things have happened. And it's not because I drank. But the good news is, when bad things happen to me, now that I'm sober, I'm not looking at those bad things and going, this is all because you drank. This is all because you're drunk. This is all happening to you because you need to be punished. Now, when bad things happen to me and I'm not drinking, I'm like, oh, well, thank God I can get through this bad thing, because I have steps and I have people around me who will help me with that part. So where I am now, despite all of my self, you know, the prison of self, you know, in the third step prayer, the bondage of self. So true. So true. One of my biggest character defects. And how hard is that to look at your character defects? Wow. Like, let's just go down the, let's say, oh, and here is your list of character defects. I'm like, oh my God, I thought I was a good person. You know, I'm going to read you one thing that I did write about how I felt, like step one. Okay, so I was like all like, oh, poetic and whatever. But this is what I wrote, and I think I wrote it back in 2018. I said, I'm living in a box held together with red clay. The clay is alcohol. It's holding me in this box. The clay is not sturdy. The clay crumbles. And to keep the box together, I have to add the ugly clay. The clay is dirty and temporary. The clay leaves stains that are so hard to get out and so much harder to look at. When the rain comes, the clay washes away, leaving a naked, vulnerable box and the ugly red clay stains. The decision, time and time again, is to simply add more clay. It seems to be the only way to keep the box, my life, together. I'm discovering a new way to remove the clay, alcohol. And this is the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I will be painstaking about this process. I will take time, and I will have to learn to deal with the clay stains. I will find comfort in knowing that some will eventually fade the stains, maybe not completely, but over time, the box, my life, will have a little vintage look instead of the ugly, dingy box that I see now. This cool vintage box, my life, will have an amazing story to it. How it was buried in the ugly red Georgia clay, and now it is sought after by others who feel buried alive in their ugly clay alcohol. So, that was that. And, you know, I mean, I can talk about anxiety for days because it's so real, especially for women. I don't know if men, you understand how much women suffer from anxiety. I don't know if, I'm not taking away from you guys if you have anxiety, but it's just different for women. You know, the hormones, you know, no but women likes to hear, it must be your time of the month. But, I mean, it is something truth. Men and women were not made equal. We were made a man and you were made a woman, and our bodies are different. And anxiety tears women up. And through studying women and alcoholism, because I really grabbed onto that when I first decided to get sober, you know, back the alcohol companies in the early 90s, maybe, they saw a market for women. And if you think back when it used to be like the Bud Light commercials and all that, they weren't geared towards women. But now you can't see an ad that's not geared towards a woman. So now it's like women, it's okay for women to drink. Like, have a drink. Oh, look, a woman who drinks like a man is no longer, like, looked down upon. I mean, that's just socially what they did. And they found a market. And I'm not saying that there's more alcoholic women because of the marketing. I'm just saying that it's interesting. It's very interesting, you know, how vulnerable and how, you know, socially acceptable it is for women to. And I think women, it takes a hold of us a lot stronger than it does men. And I don't know why. I don't know if it has to do with the anxiety. I know it did for me. I know it did for other women I watch, other women who I see relapse. Their relapses are like a freaking tiger, like, grabs onto them and just runs like, you know, you're never going to catch it. Unless you can plant your feet and start over. And that's so hard. But I've done it. I've started over numerous times. I don't know how many white chips I have because that doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is I'm standing here right now telling you my story. Sorry it was all like choppy and blah, blah, blah. But I just want you all to know that I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for all of you and people like you. And I appreciate everybody in this room. And I love to say this. I would like to end on this. I think, my personal opinion, alcoholics are the smartest, the funniest, the biggest personalities in any room they go into, whether it be in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous or a bar or whatever. Clearly we have to be smart to figure out how to, like, manage our drinking and live a life. But, I think we're the most charming individuals to be around, and that's why I like you guys. That's all I got.